On this episode of the DFA podcast, we talk about Shohei Ohtani's signing with the Angels and Giancarlo Stanton's trade to the Yankees. Keep it here. It's the DFA podcast, and it's not waving its no trade clause.
Episode 40 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, as always, my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, we've actually got some moves to talk about today. It's some big moves for a change.
Right. Yeah, it seems like everything is broken open now, which is definitely a change from the first, month plus of the offseason.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to break down to a couple of the bigger moves today. And, of course, joining us again is our producer and sometime co-host, Sean Brody. Sean, how's it going, man?
Good, good. So before we recorded last time, we were all like, oh, there's nothing going on. And then, like, almost 2 hours after we got done recording, Ohtani signed, and then the Stanton news broke, like, what, 5-6 hours later. So by the time you guys hear this, Mike Trout's probably been traded. Just be aware.
That would be awful, because we are going to take this episode to talk specifically about two moves and two teams, Shohei Ohtani and his signing with the Angels. So if Mike Trout was traded, that would seriously bum me out, because that's one of the cool narratives about that Ohtani signing. And then also we will talk a little bit about the finally consummated Giancarlo Stanton trade, where he moves from the Marlins to the Yankees. If you're listening to this podcast, you definitely already know that these two things happened. But we can hopefully go into some depth and share some insight about the moves and what we think about them and what we think this will mean for teams like the Angels and the Yankees and the Marlins moving forward. So I guess we'll kick things off with the Ohtani discussion. Shohei Ohtani signs his minor league contract to one of the least likely of the seven suitors for his services, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim of Los Angeles. RJ, I'll let you kind of kick it off first. Are you happy that Ohtani signed with the Angels? Are you sad he didn't sign with another team? What are your initial gut reactions about his choice of moving on to Los Angeles?
Well, I didn't think the Angels were likely. I actually thought the Yankees would be the favorite because they could offer him a good amount of money, the chance to join a promising young core and a large market for a storied franchise and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I was surprised that he picked the Angels. However, I would not say I'm disappointed. For one thing, I like it when we don't have all the answers, and I like it when, we're kind of humbled a bit by the game. And this was certainly a situation where I think we were all humbled because none of us really knew what was inspiring him to make his decision to call his list the way he did. So from that perspective, I enjoyed it quite a bit. And there's also just the obvious perspective that by joining the Angels, he's made them a team that's going to be more reckoned with and gives us a chance to potentially have two generational talents on one roster. And if you add in Albert Pujols and Justin Upton, and I guess to some extent Angelton Simmons, you have a lot of not necessarily the best player in baseball statuses there, but a lot of really good players from present and past and future. So it's a fun roster to examine that way. And yeah, it's just a fun situation overall. What about you?
So for me, I definitely think that this is probably the most fun of the seven possible teams that he was considering. I'm not sure it's the one that's the best for baseball, though it might be, because honestly, I don't think many of them really move the needle for best for baseball kind of thing. I kind of think I have a weird opinion on this, that I think the one that would have been the best for baseball as a whole would have been Ohtani going to the Padres, because that franchise is very – it could very much benefit from the hit of visibility that would happen. I think Andy Green would be fabulous to watch, trying to leverage him in the outfield and that kind of thing. So one little part of me was kind of hoping he would end up in San Diego. But if he couldn't end up there, this is probably my favorite fit for him. I made the comment on Twitter that this is what the only possibility I think there is in baseball for another 10-win player other than Mike Trout, and having them both be on the same team is pretty weird. I don't think he's going to be a 10-win player. I think he's going to be, you know, number two starter who hits a little bit. But, you know, if he could be worth 7 wins as a pitcher and 3 wins as a hitter in, like, the world's best-case scenario, I think that would be pretty amazing. He'd be the only person who's kind of on Trout's level, which would – it's wild to have that on the same team.
Right.
And I think the other thing is, going back to what you mentioned, like, these generational talents – so you basically on this team have the best player from the United States in Trout, the best player from Japan in Otani, and the best player from Curaçao in Andrelton Simmons. That's kind of a fun collection. I mean, how many times have you had the best player on 3 different countries on the same team?
I feel like it can't be that often, but I don't know off the top of my head if I can even think of a counterexample here.
So I don't know. I think it's a really fun, good fit. Sean, what do you think about it?
I liked it. From the beginning, I was dead set thinking he was going to go to the Seattle Mariners. And that was, I want to say, even before it was even reported that he was coming over. At my college, I have a friend who's from Seattle. He's a Mariners fan. And so I'd always joke with him, like, oh, you better watch out for Otani whenever he comes. He's going to go to the Mariners. And, like, had no base for it at all. And then when the reports came out that he was actually legitimately considering the Mariners and he made the shortlist, I was like, oh, yeah, I knew it all along. Yeah, totally. Knew he was going there the whole time. And he's going to be so interesting from so many levels, because not only is he going to change our conception of what value is in baseball, I think, because I don't know that WAR will be able to value him effectively. Like, they'll be able to value him as a player, as a hitter, and a pitcher. But, I mean, do we think that that added roster spot, or that ability to kind of cover another roster spot and let the team basically carry 26 players instead of 25, do we think that that's something that we'll end up being able to understand more as time goes on?
Well, I think that brings up a good question about kind of his overall deployment and how the Angels might use him. I kind of think that, going back to what you said about Otani's ability to add value by giving the team a 26th roster spot, I think that's useful, and I don't think there's zero value added in that. But I do think that it's going to be relatively minimal, given the specifics of the Angels roster construction and the fact that Otani probably shouldn't be expected to carry a normal workload for a starting pitcher, no matter what circumstances he's used at as a hitter. He barely pitched last year in NPB. He's used to working on a six-man rotation or a once-a-week kind of schedule. So I think whatever team uses him, I don't necessarily want to see him go – see the team, the Angels specifically, to go to a six-man rotation, because, you know, they don't have six starting pitchers, so that kind of makes things tough. But I think that if they do use him, you could expect them to skip some starts. You could expect him to go not as deep into games, especially when he gets started this season. So I kind of – I wonder if they're going to need to hold another pitcher kind of in reserve to account for that. And if that's the case, then his ability to hit and maybe being deployed as a DH might not necessarily have a huge effect on the way that the roster is composed.
So I think there's obviously an advantage to be had there because of his versatility and because, you know, he's just going to bring a lot of value to both arenas. That said, I think in the short term, they're probably going to be disadvantaged a little bit, because, you know, now they're going to have to run a six-man rotation out there, which, you know, that means you're having essentially a – not an empty spot on your roster that you're not accustomed to having, because, again, Otani could be in the lineup most days when he's not pitching. But it's certainly a different-looking situation, and it's going to be – beyond that, it's going to be a different experience for – the pitchers they already have on staff, because, you know, none of them are really used to working a six-man rotation, and I'm sure there's going to be some adjustments there. And I'm sure they're going to want to get someone like Garrett Richards additional starts over maybe someone like Matt Shoemaker or J.C. Ramirez. So it's definitely going to be a lot more complicated for the coaching staff, and particularly the pitching coach, to get everyone synced up and to get everyone on the same page when it comes to, okay, I'm throwing on this day, I need to do X, Y, Z to keep prepared for my start, because, you know, again, one day doesn't seem like a big deal to us, but when you've been trained to throw every fifth day for, you know, whatever, 10 plus years, if you're Matt Shoemaker or whomever, I think it can certainly be a big adjustment. So, yeah, I don't know if in the short term it's going to seem like an advantage to them because of all the logistical and practical adjustments they're going to have to make. But in the long run, you would think it would be an advantage, right?
I mean, I would think so. The thing that throws me is this use of the six-man rotation. So Billy Epler has reportedly said that they haven't decided yet whether or not they're going to use a six-man rotation for Otani. They could go with a traditional five, they could go with a six-man, or they could do some sort of hybrid thing where you have a regular spot starter, whatever that means, which would probably be J.C. Ramirez in this case. I guess maybe he would pitch like once every 2 weeks or something like that. I don't know. Maybe he would swap a start with Otani once every couple of weeks or something like that. The six-man rotation thing, do you think that this is a good idea for the Angels is my big question. So, and Sean, you can take that one first.
I think it depends, right? Because the six-man rotation works if you have men to fill that six-man rotation. And so I think they still need to go out and get somebody. But I'm not sure we can really answer whether it's going to work or be a good idea. I think that it'll give the bullpen more days of rest, and you might be able to see Blake Parker and Cam Bedrosian play at a higher quality. But, I mean, again, that's shooting from the hip, and I don't know that for sure. I think that it'll definitely be helpful, but to the extent of how helpful, I think that still remains to be seen. And with Otani in specific, we also have to remember he sat out most of last season with injuries. He had a bone spur he needed to be removed, and he had a thigh muscle injury, and both of them kind of prevented him from really pitching. And I think he only started hitting off the tee again back in November. So, I mean, we'll see him come in and we'll expect him to be amazing, but this is also an athlete who's recovering from injury as well. And so if it doesn't work amazingly off the get-go, that doesn't mean the Angels should just like quit on it. I think they should still, if they have a plan to do a six-man rotation, continue with it, even if it doesn't work from the beginning.
And so, RJ, what do you think about the six-man rotation? Are you for it or against it?
I guess it depends, because in theory, if it can help your starting pitcher stay healthier, and I don't know if it can, but you know, it's been proposed in the past that maybe it can, then I'm not sure any team needs a six-man rotation more than the Angels do, because Richards has made 12 starts over the past two seasons, and basically every single one of their younger pitchers have experienced some kind of arm trouble. Even Shoemaker has had forearm surgery, I think, within the last year. So, you know, from that perspective, I think this could be, in a sense, almost a blessing in disguise, because it does allow you potentially to keep these guys healthier. Now, you know, that's just theory. I don't know how it's going to work out in practice. And again, because of the reasons I mentioned before, it's probably not going to be the most popular or comfortable choice in the early going. I don't know. I'm interested to see how it works, because typically I'm against the six-man rotation because of what it does to your roster flexibility. Obviously, Otani's ability to hit kind of makes this a little bit different, or a lot bit different, really, from, you know, your typical proposed six-man rotation situation. So, yeah, I think it could help, but again, I do think there are going to be some issues in the early going until they all adjust to this, and it might take a season. I don't know. You know, like, I feel like this could actually be something that requires a full winter of preparation before they get it right and they all get comfortable with it.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable take for it. The Angels roster is weird right now. Like, they really only have two left-handed hitters other than Otani on the roster entirely, in Cole Calhoun and Luis Valbuena. The rest of the roster is right-handed. When you can talk about a Stars and Scrubs team, this is it. Their bench right now is horrible. It's really, really bad. And so, you know, maybe this is a team that will be okay using a larger bullpen because their bench pieces are so bad, you probably don't even want them on the roster. I mean, right now, Caleb Cowart's going to be the starting second baseman. I'm certain that they'll address that in some fashion. But, you know, you look at the bench, and the bench is going to be like Cowart and Jeffrey Marte, and then, I don't know, like Nolan Fontana or Reimer Liriano or Michael Hermosillo. And so, you know, you've got guys who are going to be on this bench who are – bad. They're bad. Right. They're bad or they're a replacement level. So this team definitely does need to go out and get some moves. I think that Neil Walker's like a perfect fit for this team. The combination of being able to play second and third, switch hitter, can provide some veteran leadership, you know, all that good stuff. I think he's a good fit. The team's been linked to CC Sabathia, which I think is kind of one of the more perfect fits for their rotation. Again, veteran leadership. He's a veteran guy with experience as opposed to most of the pitchers on the roster who are younger and without playoff experience. Plus, he is less of an injury risk. He's not the world's most reliable performer, but at this point in his career, he's probably less likely to go on the DL. You can probably pencil him in every fifth or sixth day. So it's not a complete roster yet. So I guess we'll really quickly say, okay, how does this affect your outlook for the team this year and beyond? I mean, obviously Ohtani makes them better, but what do you think is the most likely outcome for the Angels this season at this point, RJ?
That's a good question. And I guess I want to see what actually they do for second base and maybe the rotation and bullpen before I throw a win value on them. But I feel like they're probably going to be a team who is overrated entering the season, because I think,
really?
Well, from my perspective, yes, because you have to remember I'm a lot more conservative when it comes to injuries, particularly on the pitching side of things. And I think that I saw some of it last week. It seemed like there was already sort of a, I don't want to say like a forgetting of how fragile this rotation is, but certainly some overconfidence in these pitchers' ability to stay healthy. Because, I mean, hasn't Russell Carlton showed in the past that the best predictor of an arm injury is a past arm injury?
Yes.
And, yeah, right. Well, you know, when all of your starting pitchers basically have histories of arm injuries, I don't know. It just makes me leery. And I think that's probably the end of the spring a little higher in the projected standings than I would peg them for. And that doesn't mean I don't think it's going to be a good team, because it does seem like it has the potential to be a playoff contender and maybe even a threat to the division crown, depending on how everything works out with health and Ohtani's transition and whatnot. But it wouldn't surprise me if entering the spring I'm a little bit lower on them than everyone else, just because of my natural reservations about assuming that pitchers who have rarely stayed healthy will suddenly stay healthy just because they signed Ohtani.
I think that's really fair. The one thing that I'll say is that, as has been well documented on this podcast, I was very high on the Angels going into the end of last season, thinking that they could work around kind of these pitching injury issues because they had so much positional talent. Didn't exactly work out that way. They didn't finish the strongest that they could have to end the season. They didn't get that wild card berth. So maybe I'm a little bit on the other end. Maybe a little dose of reality like your detailing would help me out a little bit. Sean, what do you think? Do you see this team as any particular, you know, expectations going forward?
Well, I mean, even if they did not get Ohtani, this is a team that is now going to have a full season of Justin Upton in the outfield, a full season, hopefully, of a healthy Garrett Richards, a full season where Mike Trout actually has supplemental pieces around him and not just kind of doing him and hoping it goes well. I think that realistically, them being an 80-win team again was never going to be likely. They're going to go higher. I was thinking like 85, but I think they'll be somewhere higher. I think they'll be a better roster. They're definitely going to have to go out and make moves. Still, they had the Evan Longoria news float out a little earlier, and that would be interesting. That would be an interesting get, but I mean, they definitely have to go get more starting pitching. Maybe that's bringing Bud Norris back. Maybe that's getting, like you said, CC Sabathia, or I don't know, like someone like a Jaime Garcia or somebody who's a good back end starter. But I mean, currently, I think this is a better team than they were last year, but I don't think it's by much. At the end of the offseason, I think they will be a team that will challenge the Astros, but I don't think they'll ultimately overtake them.
So just from my perspective, I do not see this team as a team that's going to really challenge the Astros. The Astros, I expect them to regress a little bit from last year, but I think that there's still a clear separation between the Astros and the rest of that division. I would say, though, that even at this point, I probably see them as a favorite for a wild card spot. I think them and the Red Sox would be the two teams that I would pick as favorites for the wild card so far this offseason. There's a lot of offseason left to go, though. So I think that it's still up in the air. Like you said, we'll have to see how things kind of shake out. But I have a hard time picking another team that would be a better chance to get the first or the second wild card spot than the Angels, discounting the Red Sox if you assume that the Yankees are going to perhaps win the AL East. So that, I think, gives us a pretty natural transition point to the Yankees. So we'll kick things off talking about the Giancarlo Stanton trade. So the actual trade was that the Yankees acquired Giancarlo Stanton and apparently a $30 million payout if Giancarlo Stanton does not opt out of his contract after the 2020 season. And in exchange, the Miami Marlins receive Starlin Castro, Jorge Guzman, and Jose Devers. So, RJ, do you like this return for the Marlins?
No. Oh, look, here's the thing. I was out playing in the snow when the deal happened, and you know, my girlfriend told me the deal. She was on Twitter or whatever, and I was like, okay, and what else? Because this seems so light to me for a player of this caliber, and I know we're at the point now where everyone's really conscious of contracts and not wanting to take on this massive commitment and all this stuff. But, I mean, look what they got back. You know, Starlin Castro, fine second baseman, not going to move the needle for most teams. Actually, he would fit really well in the Angels if you think about it. So, you know, if the Marlins intend to shop him around, there you go. Maybe Castro's their answer. But, you know, he's not a difference maker, especially not in the trade of this magnitude. And then the prospects, I mean, Guzman seems interesting, but there's a possibility that he's just a reliever. And Devers, he's so far away. And I talked to Christopher Crawford in a piece for CBS about this, and he seemed to suggest that Devers' most likely outcome was as a utility infielder. So the Marlins getting back basically a fine second baseman who may or may not be on their roster come opening day, a potential mid-rotation starter whose future seems more likely to be in the bullpen, and then a infield prospect whose future seems most likely to be on the bench if he does reach the majors. That's just not an inspiring return for the reigning NL MVP and someone who, I mean, he's one of the best players in baseball, and I don't know. It just, the financial aspect just doesn't do a lot for me, because this is the Marlins and they are not going to reinvest that money, and it creates a self-defeating cycle where they trade their best players for suboptimal returns in order to save money, and they never use that money to improve their roster. So it's just a bad situation in Miami, and you know, to the Yankees' credit, they took advantage of this situation and they basically just heisted a, you know, MVP candidate to join their young nucleus. And I think in 12 to 36 months, the other three teams who were named as Stanton's finalists are going to probably have some regret about this, because, I mean, I know the contract is a big one, but how can you let the Yankees just get this guy for what they gave up?
I think it's appropriate to mention that according to Baseball Prospectus's prospect team, Jorge Guzman is not one of the Yankees' top 20 prospects, and he was the best guy who came back to the Marlins in that deal. Jose Devers is so far off the top prospect list for Baseball Prospectus and for really pretty much every other evaluator in the game that he might as well have already been on the Marlins, because he's simply not a player that has much of a future, as Christopher Crawford mentioned. He could maybe top out as a utility infielder. So this is, I mean, you heard some rumors that guys like, if the Cardinals trade had gone through, that Sandy Alcantara could have been involved. If the Giants deal had gone through, that I heard Christian Arroyo, I heard Tyler Beede, I heard a combination of those guys and Shaw and some other prospects out of San Francisco. But the Marlins seemed desperate to move on, and so they just took whatever it was the Yankees were willing to offer them. Sean, what do you think about this deal? How did you react to this when you heard it?
From a labor perspective, I really do love the fact that we have a full podcast of Ohtani and Stanton, who basically used teams as they wanted to use them, and really were able to kind of impose their will. But from a team perspective, this is god awful. Like, this is, for all the stuff we talk about the Mets on this podcast and how bad it is, man, I could not imagine being a Marlins fan right now. This is ridiculous. You have a new ownership team who came in, and they immediately went and sold a team that could have legitimately been a contender this year if you add some starting pitching to it. Like, they were probably a lot closer to contending in the NL East than they were any kind of rebuild or logistic trade of Giancarlo Stanton. This was a good roster. This is a good team, and they were a roster that was held down for quite a bit of time too. And just the fact that they came in and just tore it up, and it's only been D. Gordon and it's only been Stanton so far, but there are reports that Ozuna, Yelich being shopped around, and I mean, we saw the report back in, I believe it was September, that if Stanton was part of this roster, they wanted to cut payroll down to 80, 85 million. If he was not, they wanted to get as low as 55 million. And that's ridiculous, guys. Like, that's not even anywhere close to what you need to be putting forth for a Major League Baseball team, especially with the way that regional broadcast contracts have just exploded salaries in Major League Baseball. Like, that is an embarrassment to the game, and it's really a shame on Major League Baseball to let it happen, because there's no way you can't know this was a leveraged buyout. You knew what they were, where they got the money, then you knew how they were paying for this. You knew what the end result was going to be. And it's embarrassing. And Derek Jeter catches the brunt of it, and I think Michael Bauman had a pretty good piece on it at the Ringer over the weekend, that Jeter catches some pretty good slack, and some of it might be due, some of it might not be, but Bruce Sherman is the running head behind all of this. Jeter has a 4% stake, and he controls as a CEO, but this is some stuff it's hard to watch from the outside. And I think Stanton was right in his press conference yesterday about it.
So we can all agree that the Marlins are the worst, and that this is a bad deal for the team, because it doesn't make them better in the present. It certainly doesn't make them better in the future. So I don't know how much more there is to say about the Marlins. We expect them to cut payroll. We expect them to get down to the point where, you know, you're looking at a perhaps an Astros level of, you know, terrible, god-awful 4 or 5 seasons as they, quote, try to rebuild. But they don't have they still have a bottom five farm system even after the Stanton and the Gordon trades. It's crazy that Jorge Guzman may go from being the 21st best prospect in the Yankee system to the best prospect in the Marlins system, but that's kind of where we are. So assuming, you know, our kind of – I don't even want to talk about the Marlins side of this anymore, because it's so frustrating and depressing for Marlins fans. But I do want to talk a little bit about how this positions the Yankees going forward. Now, obviously, it makes them slightly more hateable. Obviously, it gives them fodder for really kind of weird Twin Towers jokes that you can make between Stanton and Judge in the outfield. So, RJ, I want to get your opinion on what this does for the Yankees going forward. I think initially a lot of the thought is that, well, you're adding the NL MVP. The Yankees are the best team in baseball. Where do we take it from here? But I want to kind of a little bit more of a nuanced approach to how you see the Yankees going forward. What do you think this deal does for them, and what do you think's next?
Well, obviously it improves them. I don't know if I would call them the best team in baseball, because, you know, they have some issues at second base now. They're probably going to make a change at third base, assuming they can find a taker for Headley's contract. You know, they still have to do something with Ellsbury. And you look at the rotation, and, you know, there's plenty to like about Tanaka, Severino, and Gray. And frankly, I'm a fan of Jordan Montgomery, but, you know, beyond that, I could see them adding a starting pitcher or reuniting with Sabathia or Garcia or whomever. And, you know, they do have a lot of prospects coming still with Torres and with Andujar and some of the other guys. You know, Frazier and McKinney are still there. And I'm blanking on the other outfield prospect's name right now.
Esteban Florial.
There we go. Yeah, I knew if I just threw it out there, you would have. But the point is, this is a good team. It's a deep team. However, I don't know if it's the best team in baseball. I don't know if it's the best team in the American League. But I do think they need to spend the rest of the offseason kind of addressing second base and third base. And also, you know, I don't know, like, we got big years from Gregorius and Hicks, and I guess everyone is accepting that as their true talent level now. And I don't know that I'm quite on board of that, and I will accept that I've been lower on Aaron Hicks than mostly anyone over the last 2 or 3 years. Like, when they traded for John Ryan Murphy for Hicks, I was like, I would actually prefer Murphy. And, you know, Hicks had a miserable 2016, and, you know, so did Murphy. But the point is, you know, we're not even a full year removed from us kind of talking about Aaron Hicks as just a guy who sits on your bench. So I'm not sure if I'm going to accept that he is quite as good as he showed last season. I will, you know, concede he's probably better than I'm giving him credit for, but I do think there are a few question marks on this team they have to address before I'm willing to call them the best team in the AL, let alone the best team in baseball. But like I said at the beginning, you know, this does make them better. And, you know, you look at on paper and having Judge, Stanton, Bird, Sanchez, and Gregorius as, you know, your core five at this point is pretty luxurious. And I think I just said five for four people, so you can tell that I'm just all over my – I didn't mention five people. That's right, okay. Well, that gives you an idea of how annoyed I am by this trade when I am, you know, correcting myself about something I was actually correct about.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how the outfield is going to shake out, because with Stanton and Judge, you have two right fielders. Now, Stanton, I've mentioned on this show before, is a phenomenal defensive outfielder. That having been said, and also Yankee Stadium isn't exactly the hardest ballpark to play when you're an outfielder. But that having been said, how the Yankees outfield is going to look next season is kind of a mystery to me, because they've got a lot of different ways they can go. And they've got, five or six major league ready outfielders at this point. So one of them at least has to go, right? I mean, they've got Stanton and Judge, who are no-brainers. They will be starting outfielders 150 games out of the year, barring injury. Then you've got Hicks, who you mentioned before, Brett Gardner, Jacoby Ellsbury, and Clint Frazier. So something has to give there. I don't see it as a possibility that the Yankees send Frazier back to AAA. I don't see it as a possibility that the Yankees are able to get a taker for Jacoby Ellsbury's contract, because it's something like $21 million next year, and he doesn't have that kind of value. They'd have to eat quite a bit of it, I think, to move him on. So to me, it looks like Gardner and Frazier are their two most likely trade possibilities, where they'll move one of those two guys in order to make some room for some folks. But then I also am not really sure how they'll handle the center field issue. Will it be something where they'll try to move Gardner into center field full time? Will they split time between Gardner and Hicks in center field? Or will they keep Frazier and try to do the whole thing where you have Frazier or Stanton in center field, which would be a really defensively challenged outfield? But it would be my favorite outfield of all time if they put Stanton in center and was like, hey, go for that for a year. Let's see how that works out. And then there's the DH situation, where this team looks like it's very much settled to rotate a bunch of guys into DH, you know, Gary Sanchez, whichever of the giant outfielders is not going to play in a given day. So leaving DH kind of open as a rotational position makes a lot of sense for them. But I'm really interested to see what you think that they should do with their six-person outfield that they've got right now. So, Sean, I'll let you take first crack at that.
I think Clint Frazier is most interesting in that, though, because you have effectively six more seasons of Clint Frazier. With Stanton, you have through 2027 if he doesn't opt out in 2020, and then you have Aaron Hicks through 2019, and you have Aaron Judge for six more seasons. So I think it really comes down to whether you think at the start of the 2020 season Aaron Hicks is going to be more valuable to you than Clint Frazier would be. And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know who's going to be a free agent at that time, but you're the Yankees, you could always go out and get somebody else, or you could just resign Hicks if he's going to be that good. And so I saw a report that Clint Frazier was being – the Athletics were interested in getting Clint Frazier. I think it's a bit off-put. I don't think you're going to get Clint Frazier for cheap, even if the Yankees have to move him, because they don't actually have to move him. They can just send him, like you said, to the minors, even though that wouldn't be something you'd want to do. That's always something you can go back to doing. And so I don't think they're going to give him away for cheap, but I think moving Clint Frazier would be probably your best idea because you get the highest return for him. Jacoby, I don't think he's going to go. I don't think he wants to waive the no trade clause. I think he likes it there, and it's going to be very tough to move him. But I would think Frazier is the one in the chopping block.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if they move Frazier. I mean, you know, they have the potential to get a big league caliber piece in return, somebody who can slot into one of these spots that we've been talking about with them. That said, it also wouldn't surprise me if they hold on to him and, you know, find a way to dump Ellsbury's money, maybe package him with a prospect or something, and then, you know, use those savings and use what wiggle room they have under the luxury tax to get a starting pitcher or, you know, whatever it is that Brian Cashman's heart desires. And it seems like what he desires most of all is calling his roster a merry band of men because he did it twice during the press conference. I noticed that, Cashman, if for whatever reason you listen to this. But, yeah, I mean, again, I don't really know that I'm the biggest Aaron Hicks fan around, but I think it's totally defensible to enter the season in this, you know, a situation where you're kind of juggling him and Gardner in the outfield with maybe Frazier or whomever also slotting into the outfield rotation against lefties if you want to sit Gardner or, you know, what have you. So it's certainly a good situation to be in if you're the Yankees, I think, because, you know, we're naming all these options and it's like you look at some of the other teams and, you know, they would love to have, what, 4 big league ready outfielders who you could feasibly argue should be on the roster, and the Yankees have 6. That's, you know, that's a pretty good situation to be in.
For me, I think the guy is Gardner. I think that the Yankees will finally move on from him. I understand that they might be more inclined to trade Frazier because the return will be great and because he's not even a Cashman guy. He's a guy that they brought in via trade, so maybe they're not as tied to him as a guy who's come up and developed through the organization. So I can totally see a world where they trade Frazier off for a number 3 starter as part of a package to bring somebody back. That would make complete sense to me. It seems like this is a team that's ready to make some prospect consolidation trades at some point. At the same time, I could really see Cashman getting, I don't want to say greedy, but thinking about this in terms of we're really set up for the future well in terms of prospects. Maybe we slow play it after the Stanton acquisition a little bit. Maybe we sign a third starter. We deal Brett Gardner for what would likely be a smaller return than Frazier, but we kind of hold some of our chips in reserve so that we can have a cheaper roster in the future by playing some of these prospects. We're going to need the money later because Aaron Judge is going to take some huge arbitration rises. You know, Sanchez eventually is going to as well. So maybe that's kind of what's in the cards going forward. Moving Gardner to another team, I think would be – there are a lot of teams that will probably be interested in Brett Gardner because of his flexibility in the outfield. He had a very good season last year. I think people kind of sleep on how good he was last year because he had a down 2016, but I think he was almost like a 4-win player according to BP's metrics. He's still, you know, a good if not great defender in a corner. He can play center field, and he hits. He still manages to hit. So I think that there's a lot of teams that would be like, hey, Brett Gardner is a great fit for us. Let's give up something a little bit more reasonable, and then the Yankees could get out from that contract as well.
Yeah, Gardner is always underrated. I mean, we've seen rumors about them shopping Gardner for seasons now, and I never really understood it in the past because he's like a league average hitter who – you know, as you mentioned, he's at least good in the outfield. I know some defensive metrics are really sweet on him, and they always have been for the most part. So we're talking about a guy who, and he's probably going to finish his career with around 40 wins above replacement, if not more. And somehow he plays in New York, and it doesn't seem like he really ever gets the attention he deserves. I mean, he's made one All-Star team, which maybe you can defend that by saying he's not the kind of flashy talent who's going to make All-Star games, but he's also only won one Gold Glove award, and that kind of surprised me because I think of him as one of the better outfield defenders over the last decade, and I guess I would have definitely had thought that he had won multiple at some point. I would just note that, you know, what you said about the Yankees trying to keep their payroll as lean as possible is basically just a way for us to have to talk about Ronald Torres as their starting third baseman or second baseman until Torres is ready to come up and take over one of those spots. Is that what you want, Brian? You want us to talk about Ronald Torres a lot more?
No, I don't, because I think Ronald Torres is a stalking horse. I think that Tyler Wade is a better player right now. I think Gleyber Torres is a better player right now. I think they'll give one of those guys a shot before they give Ronald Torres the everyday job. But I also think that this is not a team that's going to be like, yep, we're going to go into this season with a question mark at second base. I definitely think they'll go out and get somebody. It may not be a superstar, may not be a really high-end player, but they'll grab somebody who can stand at second base and play fairly well. Maybe it'll be Neil Walker, who has some flexibility to go to third. It would not make me completely surprised if they made an offer to Chase Utley to bring him in, or some other kind of trade for a reputable second baseman on the market. But I just I don't know. I think that this is not a team that's particularly interested in screwing around. I think Cashman wants to win.
And I just want to note, because you mentioned Tyler Wade, how good was that 2013 draft for the Yankees? They got Aaron Judge, Tyler Wade, Nick Rumbelo, Tyler Webb, Dustin Fowler, all from that draft. And I know, you know, those guys are not all of the same quality, but right there you have, within 5 years of that draft, two, three, four, five different players who have already reached the majors in some capacity or another. They used Webb in a trade. Wade and Judge are probably going to be on this roster. Excuse me, I said they used Wade in the trade. They used Fowler and Webb in a trade. Obviously, Wade and Judge could be on the opening day roster, and Rumbelo was just lost on waivers. But that is a really impressive draft, especially considering the Yankees only had, I believe, one pick in the top 30, and that was used on someone who isn't really a factor anymore. But, yeah, that's pretty impressive to me.
It's very impressive. I don't think there's any question that this team is really doing a fabulous job drafting recently. I mean, you give the Yankees a lot of – everybody tends to give the Yankees a hard time because they have all the money in the world and they use that. But they do a lot of things well. Their ability to draft has been good. You mentioned the 2013 draft. They haven't had anything that's quite that good, but they seem to hit on a lot of guys. You know, their 2014 draft, they picked up Jordan Montgomery, Jacob Lindgren. The 2015 draft, they picked up Chance Adams, who looks like he's the real thing, and James Kaprielian, who was part of a deal. You know, this is not a team that's screwing around a lot in the draft. They're doing a really nice job.
Yeah.
So, Brian, I do have – we talked about Gardner – going back to that, you know who would be a really good fit for a good center fielder that's under control for about 2 years?
There's a lot of teams, but I think you're going to say the Mets.
I am. Yeah. But you know who's not going to get him because they couldn't even trade Lucas Duda to the Yankees?
It's good. I think you're going to say the Mets again.
It's the Mets.
Yeah, the thing about Gardner is that he is a fit for 15 teams. Like, he is just a high-quality player. But a Gardner, Juan Lagares short side platoon in one of the other boroughs of New York would be pretty much perfect. But no team, especially with the Mets payroll, is going to want to spend $20 million on that particular – $15 million on that particular platoon in center field when they've – already got other stuff. So keep dreaming, Sean. It's not happening. Brett Gardner, Houston Astro. Brett Gardner with the Phillies. Brett Gardner with you know, some of these other contending teams. The Royals are a great fit for Brett Gardner. I don't know. There's at least 10 teams that would be a really, really solid fit for him.
Well, I wonder with Gardner and Ellsbury even, how much do the Yankees actually have to cut with their contracts? How much could they eat? Because we know they're trying to get under the luxury tax threshold, but they don't have to move the entirety of their contract. That probably wouldn't be feasible even. How much do you think they'd have to eat on Gardner, or they could eat, and how much do you think they would have to take with Ellsbury? Ellsbury probably more, I would assume.
Yeah, I would imagine that if Ellsbury were willing to waive his no trade clause, they'd have to eat, half to three quarters of that contract. With Gardner, I don't think they have to eat a dime. I think you could trade Brett Gardner for a reasonable return without eating any of the contract. He's only at something like $9 million for next year, I think, which is perfectly reasonable for him. Ellsbury's like $21 million. He's got years on it, so you're not going to do that. And what kind of trade would Jacoby Ellsbury want to approve at this point? Like, even if the Yankees make him the fifth outfielder for next year, was he going to be like, yeah, I want to go be the starting center fielder for the White Sox now? That sounds like fun. Like, I don't see that being in his DNA to take a trade like that. So, I think that's kind of a tough one. But, the only team that doesn't need Brett Gardner is the Angels, I feel like, at this point, because their outfield is and will continue to be the best in baseball. But you could see a left-handed hitting guy who plays good defense in center and left field is going to be a valuable commodity. You talk about how the Athletics want Clint Frazier. Well, the Athletics should want Brett Gardner, too. I mean, they just should give up far, far less to get him, which means it's probably more likely that they would go out and get a guy like Gardner. So
I'm kind of disappointed that y'all didn't touch on the Harvey for Profar rumors.
Look, we only have so much time to talk about this. And
that's our show.
Yeah.
This is called lighting the fuse, folks. That's what we who pretend to be in the industry call that.
If we get to talk about a Matt Harvey trade in the next couple of days as the winter meetings go on, we'll have another episode coming up later this week where we go over all the rest of the moves, because while these bigger moves have happened, there have been some pretty sizable ones that have been going on in the background that we'll talk about some more in another episode. But let me tell you, if you want to talk about hypothetical Matt Harvey trades, we can't even get into it because it's so weird right now that teams are out there offering real value for Matt Harvey. That's a completely other story, and it'll be fun to talk about in the future. But Sean, do you have anything else you want to hit on either Stanton or Ohtani before we call this one quits?
With Stanton, I think the biggest takeaway from this trade is that there needs to be a price floor for salary in Major League Baseball. They're absolutely, the next time that the players go into bargain with the owners, you need to fight for a price floor. Like, they're a salary floor. You cannot wait anymore, because the way that salaries are going in Major League Baseball, the money is there. You should not have an ownership unwilling to spend on their team to the extent the Marlins are, and even if you want to include the Mets in that, because the Mets should be spending in that market much more than they are spending. You need to fight for something like that, because it's only going to be good for the players. But the problem there is that I'm worried that the Major League Players Union won't actually fight for a salary floor. So,
well, it's hard because I think there are very few concessions that the Major League owners are really, jonesing for from the players, other than a larger share of profits. So it's hard because I think the Players Association has a very low bargaining power at this point. But RJ, I assume that you probably agree with Sean's statement here.
Well, I think the concession they'd want would be a lower luxury tax number. So in theory, you would get everyone to meet the floor, but it would take away from some of the top end salaries. Again, that's in theory, or excuse me, payrolls. And I don't know if that's a concession that the union should make. And I don't know if it even makes sense for either side. I'd have to think about it more. I will say in general, I'm kind of concerned about the union. Not because I think Tony Clark is a bad individual, but because I don't know if he is, cut out for the kind of tactics and the kind of approach that is needed, given how good Major League Baseball has become and how, powerful Major League Baseball is. And, you look at the last few collective bargaining agreements, and it does seem, to me at least, like the owners have the advantage here. And I know they all have always had the advantage in a sense, but it seems like the disparity has grown, and, that's not really the greatest thing if you're, interested in labor getting its fair share or getting better than its fair share. So, there are a lot of concerning aspects to that to me, and I don't know if I've had reason to be encouraged by a lot of developments here in the last few years on that front. And, the situation in Miami stinks, and it seems like it's going to get worse, and you do question why Major League Baseball approved this ownership group if they had so little in the way of, funds and liquidity and whatnot, that they had to dump basically everyone who has any kind of guaranteed money coming their way. And, you know, this is going to get painted as, oh, they're rebuilding the right way and blah, 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 because there's no such thing as rebuilding the right way. You know how we deem who's rebuilding the right way? By who rebuilds and then wins games. And this club is a long ways off from winning games. And until they actually win games, there's no sense labeling it the right way. I hate when things get labeled the right way, especially rebuilding, because you saw this. I mean, you see this all over the place. When a team says we're going to build through the draft, build the right way and all, what they're really saying is we're going to build the cheap way, because that's the cheapest way to acquire talent, is to hit on players through the draft. And a lot of time there's luck involved there. It's not always a skill thing. And I'm ranting at this point, but my big takeaway here is the Miami Marlins situation is awful for baseball, and that, yeah, I would like to see the union, you know, gain some more power here, gain some more benefits for their membership, and ideally even gain some, you know, benefits for people who play Major League, play in, you know, an organization who are not yet part of the union for various reasons. I guess that's, I should have just said minor league players, but even, you know, international players, they've gotten a raw deal here the last few years. And you see it with Ohtani. He was literally, like, no matter where he went, he was going to be underpaid versus his market value. And I think that's a shame, because, you know, maybe the next Ohtani decides he'd rather wait and get his share of the pie rather than come over here and be labeled selfless and all this stuff. And is that good for Major League Baseball? Is that good for baseball as a whole? I don't think it is. And it's unfortunate that the situation could spurt, because, you know, billionaires want to make even more money than they already have made.
So, yeah, we are all on the same page about the nature of Major League Baseball, about the nature of the owners and their quest for cash, and the nature of the Marlins being the biggest dumpster fire in Major League Baseball from a management and from an ownership and from an on-field perspective. I look forward to Kyle Bearclaw, 2018 All-Star, because he's the only decent player left on the Marlins at some point. It's going to be a weird year in Miami. I feel for anyone who was a Marlins fan, who still is a Marlins fan, which, you know, you say, like, how could the Marlins possibly have any fans after this? Well, you know, I'm still a Mets fan, and the Mets have done some pretty weird things, and their ownership group is kind of garbage, but at least, you know, and the Marlins have won World Series more recently than the Mets have, so there's something. But, yeah, I think that one of the things that will be really interesting to see in the next year or two is how the Marlins choose to come back from this, if they choose to come back from this. What steps will they take in 2019 and 2020 to show good faith, if that's something that they want to do? Because they have the opportunity, now that they've bottomed out and they've done the worst possible things, to improve. They can keep clearing payroll and not reinvest it back into the team, and that's fine. But it seems like in the past, every time the Marlins have had a fire sale like this, they have come back and tried to do something later, whether it was the 2012 Reyes and Burley acquisitions, whether it was, you know, the attempt to sign Stanton to a long-term contract by the last ownership group, which seemed like it was a play for the future. So it'll be really interesting to see what the next things are. Maybe that's false hope on my part, but I do think that there will eventually come a time when the Marlins are ready for their final hashtag Marlins takeover and improve this team.
We'll see, because this group seems even more cynical than the last group did, and that's hard to accomplish. But so far, I mean, how can you evaluate them any differently than that? That this is a very cynical group.
And we, too, are a very cynical group when it comes to the Miami Marlins. So we'll leave you with those thoughts. Thank you so much for listening and joining us. Sean, RJ, thank you so much for being a part of the show once again. You can read about the Stanton and the Ohtani transactions, as well as a host of other transactions, at Baseball Prospectus. I have a transaction analysis column up about Shohei Ohtani. I joined with Ben Diamond and some other folks to write up the Stanton transaction analysis at Baseball Prospectus. So you can check those out there. RJ, as always, you can check out at CBS Sports, where you can support RJ. You can support the rest of that great CBS Sports team. And you can also support Young Sheldon if you are so inclined to. I am
not. Oh, you got me all riled up, and now you're.
Oh,
wow. Please watch Superior Donuts and keep me solid.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
There we go. And Sean, as usual, you can follow now that he is on winter break. Maybe you can follow Sean a little bit more on Baseball Prospectus Mets and at Beyond the Box Score, or you can just keep listening to the show, which Sean, even when he's not on the show, he contributes to in a great deal by editing it. So, Sean, anything you want to plug at this point?
You hit it. It sounds depressing, but yeah.
You can find Sean Brody on Twitter lamenting potential returns for Matt Harvey in the near future. We will be back next week, but until then, please follow the show on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher. Please rate and review the show if you're so inclined. Please send us emails or tweets or literally anything you want to do to communicate with the show. You will probably be the first person, so we will probably give you some credit on the air if you choose to do that. But yeah, thank you very much for listening, and we will see you guys next time.